box. In the trunk of my car. Cutter instinctively looked over his shoulder in the general direction of the parking lot. Then he stared at Sandy. This is stuff Patrick gathered before he split. Correct. He got wind of the Aresia matter. The firm was planning to kick him out, so he very patiently collected the dirt. Bad marriage, etc., etc., so he took the money and ran. No, he ran, then took the money. Whatever. So now he wants to cut a deal, huh? Of course. Wouldn't you? What about the murder? That's a state matter, not really your concern. We'll deal with it later. We can make it our concern. I'm afraid not. You've got the indictment for the theft of the $90 million. The state of Mississippi has the indictment for the murder. Unfortunately for you, the feds can't come in now and charge murder. Cutter hated lawyers for that very reason. They didn't bluff easily. Sandy continued. Look, this meeting is a formality. I'm just going through channels. Don't want to overstep here. But I'm perfectly ready to start making calls to Washington first thing in the morning. I thought we'd have this chat, and I hoped you would be convinced we're ready to deal. Otherwise, I'm on the phone. Who do you want? Someone with complete authority, FBI and justice. We'll meet in a large room somewhere, and I'll lay out the case. Let me talk to Washington. But this better be good. They shook hands stiffly, and Sandy left. Chapter 31. Mrs. Stefano was sleeping again. Those bothersome young men in matching dark suits had left their street, and the neighbors had stopped calling with their nosy questions. The gossip over bridge had returned to more normal topics. Her husband was relaxed. She was sleeping soundly when the phone rang at 5:30 a.m. She grabbed it from the night table. Hello? A stout, firm voice said, Jack Stefano, please. Who's calling? She demanded. Jack was moving under the covers. Hamilton Janes, FBI, came the reply. And she said, Oh, my God! She placed a hand over the receiver. Jack, it's the FBI again! Jack turned on a light, glanced at the clock, took the phone. Who is it? Good morning, Jack. This is Hamilton Janes. Hate to call so early. Then don't. Just wanted you to know that we've got the girl, Eva Miranda, in custody. She's safe and secure, so you boys can call off your dogs. Stefano swung his feet out of the bed and stood next to the table. Their last hope was gone. The search for the money was finally over. Where is she? He asked, not expecting any meaningful answer. We have her, Jack. She's with us. Congratulations. Look, Jack, I've sent some men down to Rio to monitor the situation with her father. You have 24 hours, Jack. If he is not released by 5:30 tomorrow morning, then I'll have a warrant for your arrest and the arrest of Aresia. Hell, I'll probably arrest Mr. Addison at Monarch Sierra and Mr. Jill at Northern Case Mutual, you know, just for the hell of it. I've really wanted to talk to those boys, along with Aresia. You enjoy the harassment, don't you? Love it. We'll help the Brazilians extradite you guys down to Brazil, you know, and that should take a couple of months. No bail with an extradition, so you and your sleazy clients would spend Christmas in jail. Who knows, extradition might work for a change, and you'd get to go to Rio. I hear the beaches are lovely. Are you there, Jack? I hear you. 24 hours. The phone clicked and the line was dead. Mrs. Stefano was in the bathroom with the door locked, too rattled to face him. Jack went downstairs and made coffee. He sat at the kitchen table in the semi-darkness, waiting for the sun to rise. He was tired of Benny Aresia. He had been hired to find Patrick and the money, not to ask questions about how the money got created. He knew the basics of Benny Aresia's history with Platin Rockland, and he had always suspected there was much more to the story. He had probed once or twice, but Aresia showed no interest in discussing the events which preceded Patrick's disappearance. From the beginning, Jack had suspected the law firm's offices had been wired for two reasons. The first was to gather dirt on the other partners and their clients, specifically Aresia. The second was to lead Patrick to the money after his funeral. What was unknown to everyone, except to maybe Aresia and the partners, was how much damaging evidence had been taped and stored by Patrick. Stefano suspected that plenty of dirt had been gathered. When the money vanished and Stefano began his search, the law firm chose not to join the consortium. It had $30 million at stake, yet chose to lick its wounds and go home. The reason given was lack of money. The partners were basically broke, things were about to get much worse, and they simply couldn't afford to participate. This had some logic at the time, but Stefano also sensed a reluctance to find Patrick. Something was on the tapes. Patrick had caught them red-handed. As miserable as their lives had become, the actual capture of Patrick could be their worst nightmare. Same for Aresia. He'd wait an hour, then call him. By 6:30, the office of Hamilton Janes was crawling with people. Two agents sat on a sofa and studied the latest report from their contacts in Rio. One stood beside Janes's desk and waited to give an update on Aresia's whereabouts. He was still at the rented condo in Biloxi. Another stood nearby with an update on Eva Miranda. A secretary carried a box of files into the office. Janes was in his chair, on the phone, haggard and coatless, ignoring everyone. Joshua Cutter entered, also worn and wrinkled. He'd slept 2 hours in the Atlanta airport waiting for a flight to Washington, D.C., where an agent met him for the drive to the Hoover Building. Janes immediately hung up and ordered everyone from his office. "Get us some coffee, lots of it," he barked at the secretary. The room cleared and Cutter sat rigidly before the grand desk. Though mightily fatigued, he tried hard to be alert. He'd never been near the deputy director's office before. "Let's hear it," Janes growled. "Lanigan wants to cut a deal. He claims to have enough evidence to convict Aresia, the lawyers, and an unnamed U.S. senator." "What kind of evidence?" "A box full of documents and tapes, stuff Lanigan accumulated before he skipped out." "Did you see the box?" "No, McDermott said it was in the trunk of his car." "And what about the money?" "We never got that far. He wants to meet with you and somebody at Justice to discuss settlement possibilities. I got the impression he thinks they can buy their way out of it."
"That's always a possibility when you steal dirty money."
"Where does he want to meet?"
"Down there, somewhere in Biloxi."
"Let me call Sprawling at Justice," Jane said, almost to himself as he lunged for the phone. The coffee arrived. Mark Burke tapped his designer pen on the table as he waited in the visitor's room of the Federal Detention Center. It was not quite 9, much too early for lawyers to see their clients, but he had a friend in administration. Burke explained it was an emergency. The table had privacy panels on both sides and a thick glass plate down the center. He would talk to her through a small, screened opening. For 30 minutes he tapped and fidgeted. She was finally brought from around the corner, dressed in a yellow one-piece jumpsuit with faded lettering stamped in black across the chest. The guard removed the handcuffs and she rubbed her wrists. When they were alone, she sat in her chair and looked at him. He slid a business card through a tiny slot. She took it and examined every letter. "Patrick sent me," he said, and she closed her eyes.
"Are you okay?" he asked.
She leaned forward on her elbows and spoke through the screened opening.
"I'm fine. Thanks for coming. When do I get out?"
"Not for a few days. The feds can do one of two things. First, and the most serious, they can indict you for traveling under a false passport. This is a long shot because you're a foreigner and you have no criminal record. Second, and most likely, they'll simply deport you with your promise never to return. Either way, it'll take them a few days to decide. In the meantime, you're stuck here because we can't get bail right now."
"I understand."
"Patrick is very concerned about you."
"I know. Tell him I'm fine. And I'm very concerned about him."
Burke adjusted his legal pad and said, "Now, Patrick wants a detailed account of exactly how you were caught." She smiled and seemed to relax. Of course Patrick would want the details. She started with the man with the green eyes and slowly told the story. Benny had always laughed at the Biloxi Beach, just a narrow strip of sand bordered on one side by a highway too dangerous to cross on foot, and on the other by dull brown water too brackish to swim in. During the summer it attracted low-budget vacationers, and on weekends students threw frisbees and rented jet skis. The casino boom brought more tourists to the beach, but they seldom lingered long before returning to their gambling. He parked at the Biloxi Pier, lit a long cigar, removed his shoes, and walked the beach anyway. It was much cleaner now, another benefit from the casinos. It was also deserted. A few fishing boats drifted out to sea. Stefano's call an hour earlier had ruined his morning, and for the most part altered the remainder of his life. With the girl locked away, he had no chance of finding the money. She couldn't lead him to it now, nor could she be used as leverage with Lanigan. The feds had an indictment hanging over Patrick's head. Patrick, in turn, had the money and the evidence. One would be swapped for the other, and Aricia would get caught in the crossfire. When the pressure was applied to his co-conspirators, Bogan and the rest of those pansy-ass lawyers, they would sing in an instant. Benny was the odd man out, and he knew this perfectly well. Had known it, in fact, for a long time. His dream had been to somehow find the money, then disappear with it just like Patrick. But his dream was over now. He had $1 million left. He had friends in other countries and contacts around the world. It was time to split, just like Patrick. Sandy kept a scheduled 10 a.m. meeting with T.L. Parrish in the DA's office, though he'd been tempted to postpone it and spend the morning working on the documents. When he left his office at 8:30, his entire staff and both of his partners were making copies and enlarging crucial pages. Parrish had requested the meeting. Sandy was certain he knew why. The state's case had major holes in it, and now that the thrill of the indictment had passed, it was time to talk business. Prosecutors tend to try the airtight cases, and there was never a shortage of them. But a high-profile case with gaping holes is serious trouble. Parrish wanted to fish. But first he puffed and postured and talked about venue. A jury anywhere would not be sympathetic to a lawyer who murdered for money. Sandy just listened at first. Parrish recited his favorite statistics about his conviction rate and the fact that he'd never lost a capital murder trial. Got 8 of them on death row, he said, not bragging. Sandy really had better things to do. He needed to have a serious conversation with Parrish, but not today. He asked how he would prove the murder occurred in Harrison County, and he followed it by the cause of death. How could that be proven? Patrick certainly wouldn't testify and help them out. And the big one, who was the victim? According to Sandy's research, there was not a single reported murder conviction in the state with an unidentified victim. Parrish anticipated these troublesome inquiries and did an adequate job of evading concrete answers.
Has your client considered a plea bargain? He finally asked, as if in deep pain.
No.
Would he?
No.
Why not?
You ran to the grand jury, got your capital murder indictment, waved it in front of the press. Now you have to prove it. You didn't bother to wait and assess your evidence. Forget it.
I can get a conviction for manslaughter, Parrish said angrily. That carries 20 years.
Maybe, Sandy said nonchalantly, but my client has not been charged with manslaughter.
I can do that tomorrow.
Fine, go do it. Dismiss the capital murder charges, refile for manslaughter, then we'll talk. Chapter 32. It was labeled the Camille Suite, and it occupied one-third of the top floor of the Biloxi Nugget, the newest, gaudiest, largest, and most successful of all the Vegas-style casinos popping up along the coast. The boys from Vegas thought it clever to name the Nugget suites and banquet rooms after the worst hurricanes to hit the coast. For an average Joe who came in from the street and simply wanted spacious quarters, it rented for $750 a day. That's what Sandy agreed to pay. For a high roller flown in from afar, the suite would be complimentary. But gambling was the last thing on Sandy's mind. His client, less than 2 miles away, had approved the expense. The Camille had 2 bedrooms, a kitchen, den, and 2 parlors, plenty of places to meet with separate groups. It also had 4 incoming phone lines, a fax, and a VCR. Sandy's paralegal brought the PC and the technical machinery from New Orleans, along with the first batch of Aresia documents. The first visitor to Mr. McDermott's temporary law offices was J. Murray Riddleton, Trudy's thoroughly defeated divorce lawyer. He sheepishly handed over a proposed settlement of property rights and child visitation. They discussed it over lunch. The terms of surrender were dictated by Patrick. And since he was now calling the shots, Sandy found numerous details to nitpick through. "This is a good first draft," he said repeatedly as he continued to mark it up with red ink. Riddleton took the thrashing like a pro. He argued every point, bitched about the amendments, but both lawyers knew the settlement would be changed to suit Patrick's whim. The DNA test and nude photos ruled supreme. The second visitor was Talbot Mims, Biloxi counsel for Northern Case Mutual, a hyper and jovial man who traveled in a very comfortable van, complete with a fast driver, leather seats and interior, a small work table, two phones, a fax, beeper, television and VCR so Mims could study video depositions, a laptop and a PC, and a sofa for quick naps, though he succumbed only after the most arduous days in court. His entourage included a secretary and a paralegal, both of whom kept cell phones in their pockets, and an obligatory associate hauled along for extra billing purposes. The four hurriedly presented themselves at the Camille Suite, where Sandy met them in jeans and offered soft drinks from the minibar. All declined. The secretary and the paralegal immediately found matters to discuss on their cell phones. Sandy led Mims and the unnamed associate to a parlor where they sat before a huge window with a splendid view of the Nugget's parking garage, and beyond that the first steel pillars of yet another garish casino. "I'll get right to the point," Sandy said. "Do you know a man by the name of Jack Stefano?" Mims thought quickly. "No, I didn't think so. He's a super sleuth out of D.C. He was hired by Aresia, Northern Case Mutual, and Monarch Sierra to find Patrick." So, take a look at these," Sandy said with a smile as he slid a set of gory color photos from a file. Mims spread them out on the table, Patrick's horrid burns in all their glory. "These were in the newspaper, right?" he said. "Some of them." "Yeah, I think you spread them around when you sued the FBI." "The FBI didn't do this to my client, Mr. Mims."
"Oh, really?"
Mims released the photos and waited for Sandy. "The FBI didn't find Patrick."
"Then why did you sue them?"
"Publicity stunt designed to arouse some sympathy for my client."
"Didn't work."
"Maybe not with you, but you won't be on the jury, will you?"
"Anyway, these injuries were the result of prolonged torture, inflicted by men working for Jack Stefano, who was working for several clients, one of whom happened to be Northern Case Mutual, a very proud publicly owned company with a solid reputation for corporate responsibility and $6 billion in stockholders' equity." Talbot Mims was extremely practical. He had to be. With 300 open files in his office and 18 large insurance companies as clients, he didn't have time to play games.
"Two questions," he said. "First, can you prove this?"
"Yes, the FBI can confirm it."
"Second, what do you want?"
"I want a high-ranking Northern Case Mutual executive here in this room tomorrow, someone with unquestioned authority."
"These are busy people."
"We're all busy. I'm not threatening a lawsuit, but think of how embarrassing this could be."
"Sounds like a threat to me."
"Take it any way you want."
"What time tomorrow?"
4 p.m.
"We'll be here,"
Mims said, reaching forward to shake hands. He then left in a rush, his minions racing behind. Sandy's own crew arrived mid-afternoon. A secretary answered the phone, which by then was ringing every 10 minutes. Sandy had placed calls to Cutter, T.L. Parrish, Sheriff Sweeney, Mark Burke in Miami, Judge Husky, a handful of lawyers in Biloxi, and Maurice Mast, the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Mississippi. On a personal level, he called his wife twice to get reports on the family, and he called the principal of his third grader's lower school. He had spoken to Hal Ladd twice by phone, but met him for the first time at the Camille Suite. Ladd represented Monarch Sierra. He arrived alone, which Sandy found shocking, because insurance defense lawyers always traveled in pairs. Regardless of the task at hand, there had to be two of them before the work began. Both listened, both looked, spoke, took notes, and, most important, both billed the client for the same work. Sandy knew of two large, rich firms in New Orleans that, not surprisingly, had adopted a threesome approach to the practice of insurance defense. Ladd was a serious sort in his late 40s and, by reputation, didn't need the assistance of another lawyer. He politely took a Diet Cola and sat in the same seat Mr. Mims had occupied. Sandy asked him the same question. "Do you know a man by the name of Jack Stefano?" He didn't, and so Sandy delivered the standard brief bio. Then he laid the color photos of Patrick's wounds on the table, and they discussed them for a moment. "The burns were not inflicted by the FBI," Sandy explained. Ladd read between the lines. Having represented insurance companies for many years, he had long since ceased to be surprised by the depths to which they could sink. Even so, this was shocking. "Assuming you can prove this," Ladd said, "I'm sure my client would prefer to keep it quiet." "We are prepared to amend our lawsuit, drop the FBI, and name as defendants your client, Northern Case Mutual, Aricia, Stefano, and anybody else responsible for the torture. It's an American citizen intentionally wounded and scarred by American defendants. The case is worth millions. We'll go to trial right here in Biloxi." Not if Ladd had anything to do with it. He agreed to call Monarch Sierra immediately and demand that the chief in-house lawyer drop everything and fly to Biloxi. He appeared angry that his client had funded the search without informing him. "If it's true," he said, "I'll never represent them again." "Trust me, it's true." It was almost dark when Paolo was blindfolded and handcuffed and led from the house. No guns were poked at him, no threats made, no voices whatsoever. He rode in the back seat of a small car by himself for an hour or so. The radio played classical music. When the car stopped, the two front doors opened and Paolo was helped from the back. "Come with me," came a voice at his shoulder, and a large hand took him by the elbow. The road under his feet was gravel. They walked 100 meters or so, then stopped. The voice said, "You are on a road 20 kilometers from Rio. To your left, 300 meters, is a farmhouse with a telephone. Go there for help. I have a gun. If you turn around, I will have no choice but to kill you."
"I won't turn around," Paolo said, his body shaking.
"Good. I will remove the handcuffs first, then I will remove the blindfold."
"I won't turn around," Paolo said.
The handcuffs were removed.
"Now I will remove the blindfold. Walk forward quickly."
The blindfold was yanked off, and Paolo lowered his head and began jogging down the road. There was no sound behind him. He didn't dare glance around. He called the police at the farmhouse, then he called his son. Chapter 33 The court reporters arrived promptly at 8. Both were named Linda, one with an I and one with a Y. They produced business cards and followed Sandy to the center of the suite, where the furniture had been shoved to the walls and chairs added. He placed Y at one end of the room, with her back to the window with the shades pulled tightly, and sat I at the other end, in a nook next to the bar with a clear view of all the players. Both desperately needed one last smoke. He sent them into the far bedroom. Janes arrived next with his group. He had a driver, an aging FBI agent who also served as bodyguard, lookout, and errand boy, he had an FBI lawyer, and he had Cutter and Cutter's immediate supervisor. From the Attorney General's office, he had Sprawling, an intense, dark-eyed veteran who said little but gathered every sound. All 6 men wore either black or navy suits, all produced business cards, which Sandy's paralegal collected. Sandy's secretary took their coffee orders while the men shuffled as a group through the small parlor and into the den. Next came Maurice Mast, the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Mississippi, traveling light with only one assistant. He was followed by T.L. Parrish, alone, and the meeting was ready to begin. The pecking order took care of itself. Janes's driver and Mast's assistant stayed in the parlor, where they found a platter of donuts and the morning papers. Sandy closed the door, offered a cheerful good morning, and thanked them all for coming. They were seated around the room. No one smiled, yet they were not unhappy to be there. It was quite intriguing. Sandy introduced both court reporters and explained that their dual transcripts of the meeting would be kept by him and considered extremely confidential. This seemed to satisfy everyone. There were no questions or comments at this point, because they weren't sure what the meeting was about. Sandy held a legal pad with his notes neatly arranged, his case organized for a dozen pages or so. He could have been in front of a jury. He sent greetings from his client, Patrick Lanigan, and said the burns were healing nicely. Then he recapped the charges pending against Patrick. Capital murder, levied by the state. Theft, wire fraud, and flight charged by the United States. Capital murder could mean death. The others could tally up to 30 years. "The federal charges are serious," he said gravely. "But they pale in comparison to capital murder. Frankly, and with all due respect, we'd like to get rid of the feds so we can concentrate on the murder charges."
"Do you have a plan to get rid of us?" Janes asked.
"We have an offer."
"Does it include the money?"
"It does indeed."
"We have no claim to the money. It wasn't stolen from the federal government."
"That's where you're wrong."
Sprawling was itching to say something. "Do you really think you can buy your way out of this?"
It was more of a challenge. His gruff voice was flat, his words efficient. The jury was barking back at him, but Sandy was determined to follow his script. "Just wait," he said. "If you'll allow me to present my case, then we'll discuss the options. Now, I'm assuming that we're all familiar with Mr. Arisia's 1991 claim against his former employer under the False Claims Act. It was prepared and filed by the Bogan firm here in Biloxi, a firm which at that time included a new partner by the name of Patrick Lanigan. The claim was fraudulent. My client found out about it, and then learned that the firm planned to kick him out after the claim was approved by justice, but before the money arrived. Over the course of many months, my client covertly gathered evidence which proves clearly and convincingly that Mr. Arisia and his lawyers conspired to screw the government out of $90 million. The evidence is in the form of documents and taped conversations.
"Where is this evidence?" asked Janes.
"It's under the control of my client."
"We can get it, you know. We can get a search warrant and take the evidence any time we want."
"And what if my client doesn't honor your search warrant? What if he destroys the evidence or simply hides it again? What will you do then, lock him up? Indict him for something else?" "Frankly, he's not afraid of you and your search warrants."
"And what about you?" asked Janes. "If it's in your possession, we can get a search warrant for you."
"I won't produce. Anything my client gives me is privileged and confidential, you know that. It's called attorney's work product. Don't forget that Mr. Arisia has sued my client. All documents in my possession are privileged. I will not, under any circumstances, hand over the documents until my client tells me to."
"What if we get a court order?" asked Sprawling.
"I'll ignore it, then I'll appeal it. You can't win on this one, gentlemen." And with that, they seemed to accept their defeat. No one was surprised.
"How many people were involved?" asked Janes.
"The four partners at the firm and Mr. Arisia." There was a heavy pause as they waited for Sandy to announce the name of the senator, but he didn't. Instead, he looked at his notes and continued. "The deal is quite simple. We'll hand over the documents and tapes. Patrick will return the money, all of it. In exchange, the federal charges are dropped so we can concentrate on the states. The IRS agrees to leave him alone. His Brazilian attorney, Eva Miranda, is released immediately." He clicked off these terms fluidly because they had been well rehearsed, and his jury absorbed every word. Sprawling took careful notes. Janes looked at the floor, neither smiling nor frowning. The rest were noncommittal, but each had many questions. "And it has to be done today," Sandy added. "There's a sense of urgency."
"Why?" asked Janes.
"Because she's locked up. Because you're all here and you have the authority to make the decision. Because my client has set a deadline of 5 p.m. today to strike the deal, or he'll just keep the money, destroy the evidence, serve his time, and hope one day he gets out." With Patrick, they doubted nothing. He had thus far managed to spend his incarceration in a rather cushy private room with a staff at his beck and call.
"Let's talk about the senator," Sprawling said.
"Great idea," Sandy said. He opened a door to the parlor and said something to a paralegal. A table with speakers and tape deck was rolled into the center of the room, and Sandy closed the door again. He looked at his notes, said,
The date was January 14, 1992, about 3 weeks before Patrick disappeared. The conversation took place in the law firm on the first floor in a room known as the closet, sort of an all-purpose room sometimes used for very small meetings. The first voice you'll hear is that of Charlie Bogan, then Benny Aricia, then Doug Vetrano. Aricia had arrived at the firm unannounced and, as you'll see, was not in a good mood. Sandy stepped to the table and examined the various buttons. The tape deck was new and had two expensive speakers wired to it. They watched him carefully, most of them pushing forward just a little. Sandy said, "Again, Bogan first, then Aricia, then Vetrano." He pushed a button. There was a 10-second gap of complete silence. Then voices came sharply from the speakers, edgy voices. Bogan, "We agreed on a fee of 1/3. That's our standard fee. You signed the contract. You've known for a year and a half that our fee was 1/3. Aricia, "You don't deserve $30 million. Vetrano, "And you don't deserve 60. Aricia, "I want to know how the money will be split." Bogan, 2/3, 1/3, 60-30. Aricia, no, the $30 million that comes in here, who gets how much? Vetrano, "That's none of your business." Aricia, "The hell it's not. It's money I'm paying as a fee. I'm entitled to know who gets how much." Bogan, "No, you're not." Aricia, "How much does the senator get?" Bogan, "None of your business." Aricia shouting, "It is my business. This guy spent the last year in Washington twisting arms, leaning on people at Navy and the Pentagon and Justice. Hell, he spent more time working on my file than he has working for his constituents." Vetrano, "Don't yell, okay, Benny?" Aricia, "I want to know how much the slimy little crook's getting. I have a right to know how much you're shoveling under the table because it's my money." Vetrano, "It's all under the table, Benny." Aricia, "How much?" Bogan, "He'll be taken care of, Benny, okay? Why are you so hung up on this? This is nothing new." Vetrano, "I think you picked this firm specifically because of our connections in Washington." Aricia, "$5 million? $10 million? How expensive is he?" Bogan, "You'll never know." Aricia, "The hell I won't. I'll call the son of a bitch up and ask him myself." Bogan, "Go ahead." Vetrano, "What's with you, Benny? You're about to get $60 million, and now you're getting greedy." Aricia, "Don't preach to me, especially about greed. When I came here, you guys were working for $200 an hour. Now look at you trying to justify a fee of $30 million. Already redoing your offices, already ordering new cars. Next it'll be boats and airplanes and all the other toys that are seriously rich, and all with my money." Bogan, "Your money? Aren't we missing something here, Benny? Help me out. Your claim was as bogus as a $3 bill. Aricia, "Yeah, but I made it happen. I, not you, set the trap for Platt and Rockland." Bogan, "Then why did you hire us?" Aricia, "A hell of a question." Vetrano, "You got a bad memory, Benny. You came here because of our clout. You needed help. We put the claim together, spent 4,000 hours working on it, and we pulled the right strings in Washington, all with your full knowledge, I might add." Aricia, "Let's cut the senator out. That should save us $10 million. Shave another $10 million, and that leaves you boys with $10 million for yourselves. That's a much fairer fee, in my opinion." Vetrano, laughing, "That's a great deal, Benny. You get 80, we get 10. Aricia, "Yeah, and we screw the politicians." Bogan, "No way, Benny. You're forgetting something very important. If not for us and the politicians, you wouldn't be getting a dime." Sandy pushed the button. The tape stopped, but the voices seemed to rattle around the room for a full minute. The players looked at the floor, the ceiling, the walls, each trying to savor and record for later the best of what had been said. With a vulgar smile, Sandy said, "Gentlemen, this is just a sample." "When do we get the rest?" asked James. "Could happen within hours."
"Will your client testify before a federal grand jury?" asked Sprawling.
"Yes, he will. But he won't promise to testify at trial."
"Why not?"
"He doesn't have to explain. That's just his position." Sandy rolled the table to the door, knocked, and gave it back to the paralegal. He addressed his group again. "You fellas should talk. I'll step outside. Make yourselves comfortable."
"We're not talking in here," Jane said, jumping to his feet. There were too many wires, and given Patrick's history, no room was safe. "We'll go to our room."
"Whatever," Sandy said. They were all rising and grabbing briefcases. They filed through the door, through the parlor, and finally out of the suite.
Linda and Linda raced to the rear bedroom for a smoke and a pee. Sandy fixed a coffee and waited. They reassembled two floors below in a double room that immediately became cramped. Jackets were removed and thrown across the pillows of both beds. James asked his driver to wait in the hall with Mast's assistant. Matters too sensitive for their lowly ears were about to be discussed. The deal's biggest loser would be Maurice Mast. If the federal charges were dropped, he would have nothing to prosecute. A rather grand trial would vanish, and he felt compelled to at least register his objection before the others got started. "We'll look foolish if we allow him to buy his way out," he said, primarily in the direction of Sprawling, who was trying vainly to relax in a flimsy wooden chair. Sprawling was only one level down from the Attorney General himself, and this placed him several levels above Mast. He would listen politely for a few minutes to the opinions of the underlings. Then he and Janes would make the decision. Hamilton Janes looked at T.L. Parrish and asked, "Are you reasonably confident you can convict Lanigan of murder?" T.L. was a cautious type, and he knew full well any promises made to this group would be long remembered. "Murder might have some problems. Manslaughter is a lock." "How much time on a manslaughter?" 20 years. "How much would he serve?" 5, more or less." Oddly, this seemed to please Janes, a career man who thought trespassers should serve time. "You agree, Cutter?" he asked, pacing along the edge of the bed. "There's not much evidence," Cutter said. "We can't prove who, how, what, when, or where, as far as the murder goes. We think we know why, but the trial could be a nightmare. Manslaughter's much easier." Janes asked Parrish, "How about the judge? Will he sentence him to the maximum?" "If convicted of manslaughter, I would expect the judge to sentence him to 20 years. Parole is determined by the prison authorities." "Can we safely assume that Lanigan will spend the next 5 years behind bars?" Janes asked, looking around the room. "Yes, certainly," said Parrish defensively. "And we're not backing off the capital murder. We intend to make a strong argument that Lanigan killed another person so he could steal the money. The death penalty is a long shot, but if he's convicted of simple murder, he could face life in prison."
"Does it really make any difference to us whether he spends time at Parchman Prison or in a federal facility?" Janes asked. It was obvious it didn't make any difference to him.
"I'm sure Patrick has an opinion on the matter," Parrish said, and got a few weak grins. T.L. especially liked the deal because he would become the sole remaining prosecutor. Mast and the FBI would make a hasty exit from the case. There was a gap, and he decided to shove Mast a bit closer to the edge of the cliff. "I have no doubt Patrick will serve time at Parchman," he said helpfully. Mast wouldn't go quietly. He shook his head and frowned gravely.
"I don't know," he said. "I think we look bad if we do this. You can't rob a bank, then get caught, then offer to give the money back if the charges are dropped. Justice is not for sale."
"It's a bit more complicated than that," Sprawling said. "We suddenly have bigger fish to catch, and Lanigan is the key. The money he stole was contaminated. We're simply retrieving it and returning it to the taxpayers."
Mast wasn't about to argue with Sprawling. Janes looked at T.L. Parrish and said, "With all due respect, Mr. Parrish, can I ask you to step outside for just a moment? Us federal boys need to discuss something."
"Sure," Parrish said.
He walked to the door and stepped into the hallway. Enough of the chit-chat. It was time for Sprawling to close the deal.
"Gentlemen, it's very simple. There are some very important people in the White House who are watching things closely. Senator Nye has never been a friend of the President's, and frankly, a good scandal down here would make the administration happy. Nye's up for re-election in 2 years. These allegations will keep him busy. And if they're true, then he's dead."
"We'll do the investigation," Jane said to Mast, "and you'll get to prosecute."
It was suddenly obvious to Mast that this meeting was for his benefit. The decision to cut a deal with Patrick had been made by people with far more clout than Sprawling and Janes. They were just trying to keep him happy, since he was, after all, the U.S. attorney for the district. The idea of indicting and prosecuting a U.S. senator had enormous potential, and Mast warmed to it immediately. He could see himself in a crowded courtroom, playing Patrick's tapes, the jurors and spectators hanging on every word.
"So we're gonna take the deal?"
he said, shrugging as if he couldn't have cared less.
Yes, said Sprawling. It's a no-brainer. We look good by getting the money back. Patrick stays in jail for a long time. We nail even bigger crooks.
Plus, the president wants it done, Mast said, smiling, though no one else did so.
I didn't say that, Sprawling said. I haven't talked to the president about this. My bosses talk to his people, that's all I know.
Janes retrieved T.L. Parrish from the hall, and they spent almost an hour walking through Patrick's offer and examining each of its components. The girl could be released with an hour's notice. Patrick would also have to pay interest on the money, they decided. What about the lawsuit he'd filed against the FBI? Janes made a list of points to cover with Sandy. In Miami, Mark Burke personally delivered to Eva the wonderful news that her father had been released. He had not been harmed. In fact, had been treated quite well. He told her that with a little luck, she might be released herself in a day or two. Chapter 34 Solemn-faced and non-committal, they returned to the Camille suite and took their same seats. Most had left their jackets in the other room and had rolled up their sleeves and loosened their ties, as if all manner of hard work was underway. By Sandy's watch, they had been gone for almost an hour and a half. Sprawling was now their spokesman.
"About the money," he began, and Sandy instantly knew they had a deal. It was just a matter of the details. "About the money. How much is your client willing to return?"
"All of it."
"All of it being?"
"All 90 million."
"What about interest?"
"Who cares about interest?"
"We do."
"Why?"
"Well, it's only fair."
"Fair to whom?"
The taxpayers.
Sandy practically laughed at him.
Come on. You guys work for the federal government. Since when do you worry about protecting the taxpayers?
It's standard in cases involving theft and embezzlement, Maurice Mast added.
How much? Sandy asked. At what rate?
Prime is 9%, Sprawling said. That would be fair, I think.
Oh, you do? What does the IRS pay when it determines I've paid too much and it sends me a refund?
No one could answer.
6%, Sandy said. 6 lousy percent is what the government pays.
Sandy, of course, had had the benefit of planning this. He had anticipated the questions and had crafted the answers, and it was enormous fun watching them squirm as they tried to catch up.
So, are you offering 6%? Sprawling asked. His words were careful and slow.
Of course not. We have the money. We'll determine how much we'll pay. It's the same principle used by the government. We figure the money will simply go back into the black hole at the Pentagon.
We can't control that, Jane said. He was already tired and in no mood for a lecture.
Here's the way we see the money, Sandy said. It would have been lost entirely, paid to some very slick crooks and never seen again. My client prevented this, has held the money, and is now willing to return it.
"So we give him a reward?" asked Janes.
"No. Just back off the interest."
"We have to sell this to some people in Washington," Sprawling said, not pleading but needing help. "Give us something to work with."
"We'll pay half the IRS rate and not a penny more."
With a serious poker face, Sprawling said,
"I'll run it by the Attorney General. I just hope he's in a good mood."
"Give him my regards." Sandy said.
Janes looked up from his note-taking and asked, 3%, right?
That's right. From March 26, 1992 until November 1, 1996. Total comes to 113 million plus some change, which we'll ignore. 113 million even.
The figure had a nice ring to it, and it certainly sounded good to the government boys. They each wrote it on their legal pads. It looked large. Who could argue with a deal that brought so much back into the hands of the taxpayers? To offer this much meant only one thing. Patrick had taken the 90 and invested well. Sprawling's boys had crunched some numbers earlier. Assuming Patrick placed all the money in investments earning 8% a year, the loot would now be worth 131 million. 10% and the value would be 144 million. Tax-free, of course. Apparently Patrick hadn't spent much of it, so he would remain a very wealthy man.
"We're also concerned about this lawsuit you filed on behalf of Mr. Lanigan," Sprawling said.
"We'll dismiss the FBI from the lawsuit, but I'll need a quick favor from Mr. Janes. We can discuss it later. It's a minor point."
"All right, moving right along. When will your client be prepared to testify before the grand jury?"
"Whenever you need him. Physically, he's able to do it any time."
"We intend to move quickly with this."
"The sooner the better for my client." Sprawling circled items on his checklist.
"We will insist on confidentiality, no press whatsoever. This deal will be subject to a lot of criticism."
"We're not saying a word," Sandy promised.
"When would you like for Ms. Miranda to be released?"
"Tomorrow. And she needs to be escorted from the jail in Miami to the private air terminal. We would like FBI protection until she's on the plane."
Jane shrugged as if he didn't understand.
"No problem," he said. "Anything else?" Sandy asked, rubbing his hands together as if the fun was about to start.
"Nothing from the government," Sprawling said.
"Good. Here's what I suggest," Sandy said, as if they had a choice. "I have two secretaries here with PCs. We have already prepared a rough draft of a settlement agreement and order of dismissal. It shouldn't take too long to hammer out the finer points, then you guys can sign off. I will then drive it over to my client, and hopefully within a couple of hours we'll be finished. Mr. Mast, I suggest you contact the federal judge and arrange a conference call as soon as possible. We'll fax him the order of dismissal."
"When do we get the documents and tapes?" asked Janes.
"If everything gets signed and approved in the next few hours, you can have them at 5 p.m. today."
"I need a phone," Sprawling said. So did Mast and Janes. They scattered throughout the suite.
Regular inmates received an hour each day outdoors. It was late October, a cool and cloudy day, and Patrick decided to demand his constitutional rights. The deputies in the hallway said no, it had not been authorized. Patrick called Carl Husky and got everything approved. He also asked Carl if he could stop by Rossetti's on Division Street near the Point and pick up a couple of Van Cleve specials, crab meat and cheese po' boys, and join him for lunch outside. Carl said he would be delighted. They ate on a wooden bench, not far from a small fountain and a sad little maple. The various wings of the hospital surrounded them. Carl had brought po' boys for the deputies as well, and they sat nearby, just out of earshot. Carl knew nothing of the meeting underway at the hotel suite, and Patrick didn't tell him. Parrish was there, and before long he would tell his honor. "What are people saying about me?" Patrick asked after he finished a third of his sandwich and put it away.
"The gossip has died down. Things are back to normal. Your friends are still your friends."
"I'm writing letters to some of them. Would you deliver them?"
"Of course I will."
"Thanks."
"I hear they caught your lady friend in Miami."
"Yeah, but she'll be out soon. Just a small problem with her passport."
Husky took a large bite of his sandwich and chewed in silence. He was growing accustomed to the long, quiet intervals in their dialogue. He struggled with what to say next. Patrick did not.
"The fresh air is nice," he finally said. "Thanks."
"You have a constitutional right to fresh air."
"You ever been to Brazil?"
"No."
"You should go."
"Like you, or with my family?"
"No, no. Go visit sometime."
"The beaches?"
"No. Forget the beaches, and forget the cities. Go to the heart of the country, to the open spaces, where the sky is clear and blue, the air is light, the land is beautiful, the people are gentle and uncomplicated. It's my home, Carl. I can't wait to go back there."
"Might be a while."
"Maybe.
But I can wait."
"I'm not Patrick anymore, Carl. Patrick is dead. He was trapped and unhappy. He was fat and miserable, and thankfully he went away. I'm Danilo now. Danilo Silva, a much happier person with a quiet life in another country. Danilo can wait."
And with a beautiful woman and a large fortune, Carl wanted to say, but he let it pass.
"How does Danilo get back to Brazil?" Carl asked.
"I'm still working on that."
"Look, Patrick, I guess it's okay if I call you Patrick and not Danilo."
"Sure."
"I think it's time for me to step down and give the case to Judge Trussell. Some motions will soon be due, and rulings will have to be issued.
I've done all I can do to help you.
Are you taking some heat?
A little, but nothing that worries me. I don't want to hurt you, and I'm afraid if I keep your case much longer, people might resent it. Everybody knows we're friends. Hell, you even picked me as one of your pallbearers.
Did I ever thank you for serving?
No. You were dead at the time, so don't mention it. It was fun.
Yeah, I know.
Anyway, I've talked to Trussell, and he's ready to take the case. I've also told him about your heinous injuries and how important it is for you to stay here for as long as possible. He understands.
Thanks.
But you have to be realistic. At some point, you're going to be put in jail, and you might be there for a long time.
Do you think I killed that boy, Carl?
Carl dropped the remains of his sandwich into a bag and drank his iced tea. He was not inclined to lie about this.
It looked suspicious. First, there were human remains in the car, so somebody was killed. Second, the FBI has done an exhaustive computer analysis of all persons who became missing on or shortly before February 9, 1992. Pepper is the only person within 300 miles who has not been heard from.
But that's not enough to convict me.
Your question was not about getting a conviction.
Fine. Do you think I killed him?
I don't know what to think, Patrick. I've been a judge for 12 years, and I've seen people stand before me and confess to crimes that they still couldn't believe they committed. Under the right circumstances, a man can do just about anything.
So you believe it?
I don't want to. I'm not sure what I believe.
You think I could kill someone?
No, but I didn't think you could fake your death and swipe $90 million either. Your recent history is full of surprises.
Another long pause. Carl glanced at his watch. Patrick left him on the bench and walked slowly around the courtyard. Lunch in the Camille suite was an array of bland sandwiches served on plastic trays, and it was interrupted by a return call from the federal judge who had been assigned Patrick's case 4 years earlier. The judge was in the middle of a trial in Jackson and had only a minute. Mast described the cast of players assembled in the suite, and the judge consented to being placed on a speakerphone. Mast then gave a hurried summary of the proposed agreement. The judge wanted to hear Sandy's version next, and he delivered it. Sprawling was asked a few questions, and the short phone conference became a lengthy one. At one point, Sprawling left the room to chat privately with the judge. He conveyed the urgent wishes of higher-ups in Washington to cut the deal with Mr. Lanigan so bigger fish could be caught. The judge also talked privately with T.L. Parrish, who gave the same assurances that Lanigan was not walking away, that he would indeed face the more serious charges, and in all likelihood, though no guarantees were given, spend many years in jail. The judge was reluctant to act in such a hurry, but with pressure from those so intimately involved with the case, and given the stature of those present in Biloxi, he relented and agreed to sign the order dismissing all federal charges against Patrick. The order was promptly faxed to him, and he promptly signed it and faxed it back. As they finished lunch, Sandy left them briefly for a quick drive to the hospital. Patrick was in his room writing a letter to his mother when Sandy burst in. "We did it!" He threw the agreement on Patrick's work table. "We got everything we wanted," he said.
"Full dismissal?"
"Yep. The judge just signed it."
"How much money?"
"90 plus 3%.
Patrick closed his eyes and clenched his fists. The fortune had just taken a major hit, but there was plenty left. Enough for him and Eva to one day settle down somewhere safe and have a house full of kids. A large house. And many kids. They scanned the agreement. Patrick signed it, then Sandy raced back to the hotel. The crowd had thinned by 2 p.m. when the second meeting got started. Sandy welcomed Talbot Mims and his client, a senior VP for Northern Case Mutual named Chenault, who brought with him 2 in-house lawyers whose names Sandy missed. The crowd had thinned by 2 p.m. when the second meeting got started. Sandy welcomed Talbot Mims and his client, a senior VP for Northern Case Mutual named Chenault, who brought with him 2 in-house lawyers whose names Sandy missed.
For good measure, Mims also brought one of his partners and an associate, both nameless, too. Sandy collected their business cards and escorted them into the same parlor where the first meeting had taken place. The court reporters took their positions. Janes and Sprawling were next door in the den on the phone to Washington. They had sent the rest of their entourage down to the casino for an hour of leisure, no alcohol. The squad from Monarch Sierra was much smaller, just Hal Ladd, one of his associates, and the chief in-house lawyer for the company, a dapper little man named Cohen. Stiff introductions were made around the room, and they all settled in to listen to Sandy. He had packets for them, thin folders which he distributed and asked them to flip through. Each contained a copy of the lawsuit filed by Patrick against the FBI for his injuries, and each had a set of color pictures of the burns. The insurance boys had been prepped by their lawyers, so none of this was a surprise. Sandy summarized what he had alleged yesterday, that the injuries to his client had not been inflicted by the FBI because the FBI didn't find Patrick. Stefano did. And Stefano was working for three clients, Benny Aricia, Northern Case Mutual, and Monarch Sierra. All three had serious exposure in a civil liability suit to be filed by Patrick.
"How do you plan to prove the Stefano business?" asked Talbot Mims.
"Just a second," Sandy said. He opened the door that led to the den and asked Janes if he had a minute. Janes entered the room and identified himself to the group. With great pleasure, he described in detail the things Stefano had told them about the search for Patrick, the financing of the consortium, the rewards, the tips, the hunt in Brazil, the plastic surgeon, the boys from Pluto, the capture, and the torture. Everything. And all done with money provided by Aricia, Monarch Sierra, and Northern Case Mutual. And all done solely for their benefit. It was a dazzling performance. One Janes himself enjoyed immensely. "Any questions for Mr. Janes?" Sandy asked happily as the narrative came to a close. There were none. In the past 18 hours, neither Chenault of Northern Case Mutual nor Cohen of Monarch Sierra had been able to determine who in their companies had authorized the hiring of Jack Stefano. It was unlikely they would ever know, now that tracks were being erased. Both companies were large and rich, with lots of shareholders and big ad budgets used to protect their good corporate names. Neither wanted this headache.
"Thank you, Mr. Janes," Sandy said.
"I'm next door if you need me," Janes said, as if he would like nothing better than to return and do some more coffin nailing. His presence was baffling and ominous. Why was the deputy director of the FBI in Biloxi, and why did he seem so eager to place blame on them? "Here's the deal," Sandy said when the door was shut. "It's simple, quick, non-negotiable. First, Mr. Chenault, as to Northern Case Mutual. Your client's last assault in this little war is an effort to recoup its $2.5 million paid to Trudy Lanigan. We prefer that you simply go back home. Dismiss the lawsuit, forget about Trudy, let her live in peace. She has a child to raise, and besides, most of the money's been spent anyway. Dismiss, and my client will not pursue his claim for personal injuries against your company."
"Is that all?" Talbot Mims asked in disbelief.
"Yes, that's it."
"Done."
"We'd like a moment to consult," Chenault said, still hard-faced.
"No, we don't," Mims said to his client. "It's a great deal. It's on the table. We take it, just like that."
Chenault said, "I'd like to analyze—"
"No," Mims said, bristling at Chenault. "We take the deal. Now, if you want someone else to represent you, fine, but as long as I'm your lawyer, we're taking the deal right now."
Chenault went speechless.
"We'll take it," Mims said.
"Mr. Chenault?" Sandy said.
Sure. I guess we'll agree to it."
"Great. I have a proposed settlement agreement waiting on you in the room next door. Now, if you gentlemen will leave us for a few minutes, I need to talk with Mr. Ladd and his client in private." Mims led his crew out. Sandy locked the door behind them and turned to address Mr. Cohen, Hal Ladd, and his associate. "Your deal is a bit different from theirs, I'm afraid. They get off lightly because there's a divorce. It's messy and complicated, and my client can use his claim against Northern Case Mutual to his advantage in the divorce proceedings. You, unfortunately, are not in the same position. They put up $500,000 for Stefano, you put up twice that much. You have more liability, more exposure,
And, as we all know, a hell of a lot more cash than Northern Case Mutual.
How much do you have in mind? Cohen asked.
Nothing for Patrick. He's very concerned, however, about the child. She's six, and her mother burns money. That's one reason Northern Case Mutual collapsed so quickly. It'll be very difficult to collect from Mrs. Lanigan. Patrick would like a modest amount to go into a trust fund for the child, money out of the mother's reach.
How much?
$250,000, plus the same amount to cover his legal fees. Total of $500,000, paid very quietly so your client won't be embarrassed by those pictures.
The Coast had a history of generous verdicts in personal injury and wrongful death cases. Hal Ladd had advised Cohen that he could see a multi-million-dollar verdict against Aresia and the insurance companies for what was done to Patrick. Cohen, from California, certainly understood this. The company was quite anxious to settle and leave town.
All litigation is dismissed, Cohen said.
And we pay $500,000?
That's it.
We'll do it.
Sandy reached into a file and removed some papers.
I have a proposed settlement agreement, which I'll leave with you.
He handed copies to them and left them. Chapter 35. The psychiatrist was a friend of Dr. Hayani's. Patrick's second session with him lasted for 2 hours and was as unproductive as the first. It would be the last. Patrick asked to be excused and returned to his room in time for dinner. He ignored most of it as he watched the evening news. His name was not mentioned. He paced the floor and spoke to his guards. Sandy had called throughout the afternoon with updates, but he wanted to see documents. He watched Jeopardy and tried to read a thick paperback. It was almost 8 when he heard Sandy speak to the guards and ask how the prisoner was doing. Sandy enjoyed referring to him as the prisoner. Patrick met him at the door. His lawyer was exhausted but smiling.
It's all done, he said as he handed Patrick a stack of paperwork.
What about the documents and tapes?
We handed them over an hour ago. There must have been a dozen FBI agents swarming around. James told me they would work through the night.
Patrick took the settlement agreements and sat at his work table in the corner, under the television. Carefully, he read every word. Sandy's dinner was fast food from a bag, and he ate it standing beside the bed, watching muted rugby from Australia on ESPN.
Did they squawk at the $500,000? Patrick asked without looking up.
Not for a minute. Nobody squawked at anything.
Guess we should have asked for more.
I think you have enough.
Patrick flipped a page, then signed his name. Good work, Sandy. A masterful job.
We had a good day,